Hello, and welcome to the final episode in Season 8 of the Learn to Code with Me podcast. I'm your host, Laurence Bradford, and today's episode is all about how a former college rugby player and film student became a software engineer at a startup with no prior tech experience. But first, a quick word about this season's wonderful sponsor. Whether you want to build your portfolio or you're ready to create your first web app, Linode can get you there. Linode is a cloud hosting service that provides virtual servers you can use to get your app, website, or another service online. Their pricing is simple, with no hidden fees, and packages start from just $5 a month. But Linode also has the infrastructure to grow with you as your projects take off. Choose Linode for your next project and support Learn to Code with Me at the same time by going to linode.com/learntocode. You'll get $100 in free credit when you create your account. Can't wait to see what you build. And we're back. In today's episode, I talk with Mike Pogue. Mike is a software engineer at Teachable, where he leads the internal tools team. In fact, he was one of their very first employees back when it was a tiny startup in 2014. And he and I used to work together at Teachable. The reason why I reached out to Mike and invited him on the show is because his background has always fascinated me. He went from being a film student and rugby player at Columbia University, and then he got into technical recruiting. Then he was a customer support rep, all the way to becoming a software engineer, which is what he does today. And he did all of this without a computer science degree, without going to a coding bootcamp or an internship. And that's what we're going to be talking about today. How Mike got his job at Teachable, what internal tools are and why they matter to a company, and what his experience has been like working at an early stage to now a medium stage startup. Our conversation also touches on the importance of learning to code by doing and unique ways that you can break into tech if you're coming from an unrelated background. If you want to learn how to code without a computer science degree or going to a boot camp, or want to learn more about working at startups, this episode is for you. And as I said at the start, this is our final episode of Season 8. All right, enjoy the interview. Hey, Mike, thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah, thank you. Glad to be here.
Yeah, so you're the first guest I think I've ever had on the show that I actually worked with in real life, you know, in the past. But for the purposes of this interview, I'm just going to act like I don't know anything about you and ask questions like it's the first time I'm asking them.
That works. I have no idea who you are, so that totally works for me.
Okay, perfect. So I would love just to kind of set the stage and just like find out where are you living currently and then where are you from originally?
Right now, I'm actually based in Jersey City, which for folks who don't know, the New York City area is basically New Jersey's Brooklyn. It's right across the river from Manhattan. And originally, I'm from Southern California, a little town called Redlands, which is like about an hour east of LA.
All right. Awesome. So what were you doing before you got into tech? So like specifically, I'm thinking like, what did you study in college? And what were you even doing immediately after college?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I went to college for film studies and philosophy, which I'm sure most people can understand are super lucrative businesses to be in. And immediately after college, I actually worked at an unpaid film internship in Midtown Manhattan. It was pretty nice. We shot like music videos, a few like product videos for folks. It was all unpaid. And, you know, in Manhattan, you can't really live off of no money. So eventually, I actually had to start working as a technical recruiter. I got hooked up with this job through a college friend who was working as a recruiting manager at the time. And it was basically just like a pretty standard recruiting agency setup. Like it wasn't at a company. We were just kind of working as one of 50 vendors trying to fill various jobs in the financial services industry. And interestingly enough, that was one of the first real ways I started to get exposed to technology because I was recruiting a lot of software developers and like product managers and those kinds of people. And so I started having to actually understand like, oh, okay, that's how computers work. But yeah, that was a bit of what I was doing immediately after college. And then eventually I kind of stumbled into a programming role.
Right, right. So how long were you doing the technical recruiting after college?
I want to say about 9-ish months. Like, I want to say I started working there in September 2013, and I was actually let go. Unfortunately, I could not hit my numbers. I want to say around April or May 2014. So I'm bad at math, however many months that is.
Got it. So going back a little bit, when you were in college, okay, you played football as well, right?
I played rugby.
Rugby. Okay, wait, why did I think you played football? Did you play football in high school?
So I did play football in high school. I played a little bit of football in college. Various reasons it wasn't working out, but eventually I started playing rugby in college.
Okay. Okay, got it. Because I was going to ask, like, what, back when you were in school and you were, you know, playing sports and studying these things, what did you think you wanted to do after college? Or did you not really think too far ahead?
I mean, I definitely wanted to be a film editor. That was one of the things I really wanted to do. And I still kind of want to eventually go back into filmmaking. But I did find that I really enjoyed the editing process a lot. So actually, when I worked that unpaid internship, most of it was film editing versus shooting. And so I did expect to eventually get a job, probably shooting something or editing something like wedding videos, because those are oddly lucrative, but something like that. But unfortunately, in the city, there just wasn't an opportunity where I could get that. So originally I wanted to do that and then eventually find some other job making movies.
Got it. I only asked that because when I was in college, I didn't really know what I wanted to do. And I, you know, studied history and economics. Yeah, which just feels very random at the time, but I always liked history. But in any case, so you know, back to your story here. Mm-hmm. So you were in technical recruiting. Okay, you did that for like 9 months or so. And how did you end up working at Teachable, which is this tech startup that I ended up working at? That's how we ended up connecting. When did all of that start coming together?
Yeah, so that situation has a very interesting sort of genesis. So basically what happened was, like I mentioned, I was working as a technical recruiter. And like, oddly enough, Halloween, the year I had been, so I guess this was October 2013, I had gotten my jaw broken around then, like, you know, I'd gotten mugged, all that stuff. So I actually had to take like about 6 weeks off of the job because as a recruiter, I was on the phone and I had been calling and stuff. And those 6 weeks were probably the best time for me as a recruiter. And that was when I realized, okay, I need to get the heck out. So at that point, I had actually applied to a developer bootcamp called Dev Bootcamp at the time. And I had gotten in and I was actually planning on joining their, I want to say like late summer, fall 2014 cohort. And so I, like I mentioned, I got let go as a recruiter because I wasn't able to hit the numbers. And honestly, I was just burned out. So I had taken time off and then I was actually studying to become a part of the Dev Bootcamp cohort. At the time, another buddy from college, a different one than the one that got me the job at the recruiting firm, a guy named Noah Pryor, he was working at a company called iCapital Network. He and I were hanging out. We started working on some side projects and stuff. Eventually, we move in together and we're working on some projects on the side. We have this app called Truckdar. It's like seamless for food trucks. Literally went nowhere, so you probably haven't heard of it. And he eventually needed to get another job. And so he was like, I got to go work at this place called Fedora. At the time, Teachable was called Fedora. And going back to my original point, you need money to live in New York City. So I also needed a job. And so I was trying to raise money for the Dev Bootcamp cohort. It was about 15 grand at the time tuition, which I didn't have. And so thankfully through Noah, I was able to get a job at Teachable. And at the time I was doing stuff like working our marketing site. I was building that out. I was interacting with customers as customer support. I was doing stuff like we partnered with this one content creator who had an ebook and I was sending out ebooks to people manually. So it was through a buddy Noah that I kind of transitioned from technical recruiting into studying for a boot camp to not going to a boot camp, but instead getting a job instead. Yeah. So yeah, that's kind of how I ended up at Teachable.
Wow. I actually didn't know the part about having your jaw broken and all of that. So, oh, wow. That actually sounds really scary. But you said during those 6 weeks off you had to take, you started like looking into programming?
Oh, yeah. Because again, like my jaw, it wasn't wired shut, but it was like rubber banded shut, like couldn't eat solid food for a couple weeks. And I was just like, oh, this is so much better than waking up at like 5:30 to go into the office and have to wear a suit and be clean shaven to spam message people about like jobs in rural North Carolina. Like it was just that realization that like, I prefer having my jaw broken to doing my job. I probably need to make a career change because that's a very skewed priority set. So,
yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. That definitely makes tons of sense. And well, I guess it's kind of like a, I don't want to say it was a blessing that you got your jaw broken, but kind of a blessing in disguise that you had that time off to sort of reevaluate. Right.
Yeah. It definitely helped.
Yeah. So, okay. So you were thinking of going to a programming boot camp that never happened, right? So you never ended up going. Okay. And then you started working at Teachable, right? So when you were learning like more about coding and programming, how were you learning? Like, were you taking courses? Were you reading books? Were you just learning as you built different things?
Honestly, it was mostly a combination of all of that stuff. Plus, like I said, I was very fortunate to have a close friend in Noah to actually work on. And he had about a year and a half as a professional engineer. So like I could actually ask him questions and he would kind of work them through with me. But yeah, I did a lot of like, you know, just reading stuff online, watching YouTube videos and copying and pasting what they did and just kind of tweak stuff to my need. Yeah, I don't think I did anything like Code Academy or anything like that. I believe at the time when I was learning, it was still fairly new. But yeah, mostly just self-taught, kind of working on, admittedly, I hope I could say this, but Ratchet applications. Like my favorite was this one called Hood Roulette, which basically, if you're familiar with Chat Roulette, it's the same idea, except it would show you random hood fight videos. Like I would just find like little goofy things like that that I would just be like, oh, that would be fun. And I would just try and figure out how to make them. Another good example was, if you're familiar with the game Minesweeper, where you have to click the squares to not find the mine. I did one which was a Facebook game called Friend Sweeper, where it just took your Facebook friends and used them as the tiles instead. So I just found like little things like that and then looked online, found an article that seemed kind of like what I needed to do, tweaked it, and just kind of did that for a few months until I got my first job.
Yeah, that's, I'm laughing because you're also just so creative. Like, I feel like you have all these different ideas that like no one else would really think of. And one of the most common questions that people ask is, what do I build? Like, I know I should build different things to help me learn, but how do I come up with ideas? But it feels like you have no shortage of ideas of things to build.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely something that I can appreciate people struggling with. And even I can struggle with it. Like it's, for instance, I'm pretty well known as like the punny guy, right? Like at work, people always like expect me to say like the goofy jokes and stuff. But if you ask me like, hey, Mike, come up with a joke, I'm like, I don't know. Like this is how I felt when I first met my fiance's dad, because, you know, he likes puns. And it's like, hey, you'll love each other. Just say jokes. And I'm like, I can't do this on the spot. So I can appreciate why it's hard to find an idea. But in terms of like good ideas on stuff to work on when you're first learning to program, start with stuff you like. So like, let's say you know how to play the bass and you want to learn how to program, but you have no idea where to start. Build something about basses, right? You know, musical tabs. So maybe you have a little form where you type in the song name and it shows you the tabs from like four or five different websites, right? If you build that application, you're going to learn so much about how to program, and it's going to feel relevant because it's something you actually want to do. I think one of the biggest problems with the way people kind of approach learning programming initially is like they just build that bog standard Twitter clone app, which honestly, most people don't get that excited over Twitter. And so it's really hard to actually understand the concepts and stuff if you're just building something that you have no passion for. So I would say, if you're into theater or arts and crafts or cars or like literally anything, try and figure out something geared to that and you'll probably be more successful. People all learn differently, but that's something I found to be pretty helpful. Small aside, I know my fiance recently actually switched jobs from being a data analyst to being a data scientist, and she went through a boot camp and I kind of offered similar advice to her, and she did a project on Parks and Rec, because she loves Parks and Rec. Basically, given a script, can you analyze the content to tell who's the primary focus of the episode? And whenever she's on interviews, trying to get a job and stuff, like, that's the project people gravitate towards, you know, one, because everyone likes Parks and Rec, but that's also where she showed a lot of growth and, like, whatnot. And so, again, most people like something, and so try and figure out a project based around that, and, you know, the rest will kind of fall into place.
Yeah, awesome. That's great advice. So going back to you at Teachable and starting to work there and getting your foot in the door through Noah, how many people were working there at the time?
Let's see. There was Chris, Jack, Conrad, Anker, Noah. So there were five people there. So I was the sixth person in the door, not counting the two founders. So of, like, actual, like, employees, I was basically number four. And yeah, that was a very interesting time because originally I had interviewed with Conrad, who was one of the co-founders at the time. And it was at a 500 startups office where there was nobody in there. It looked kind of abandoned. And it was like a 10-minute interview where it's basically like, hey, you seem chill. Do you want to build our website for us and help out? And I was like, sure, can you pay me? And he was like, yeah, we could do that. Okay, cool. So yeah, it was a very interesting experience when I first joined. And then my very first day, we were same amount of people, but we actually moved offices into a WeWork down in it was the Fulton Avenue WeWork down in a financial district. Yeah, but I want to say for the first 3 or 4 months, we were basically at that size until we brought on Sid, who was a front-end engineer at Teachable, who eventually, you know, went on to become a VP of product at Teachable. He came over, I want to say, around October or September, and I started August. So yeah, very small at the time.
Yeah, and you were doing so much at the beginning. I mean, I think you gave us a glimpse like a few minutes ago when you were talking, but you were doing things from like the marketing site, and weren't you also answering a lot of support tickets?
Yeah, at the time I was basically like the support guy. And so what would happen is like somebody would write in and let's say a dozen people had some nasty bug. If it wasn't like mission critical, then I would also try and patch the bug and respond back to them. And again, I was also helping out with the marketing site. When Sid came on, because he was a front end person, he would help out with that stuff. But yeah, early days, it was a lot of grinding. I'm not super sure if your audience is familiar with him, but if they know of a gentleman named Brian Holiday, he had probably one of the most interesting course launches in Teachable history. He was the first big partner with us. He had an ebook about growth hacking that he released on the platform as a course. And every single person who bought the course was supposed to get either a ebook or a physical copy of the book mailed to them. And Amazon didn't have an API for this at the time. And I want to say he sold several hundred, if not thousand copies. And so like one of the things I would do is I would go into our Amazon account and like physically fulfill those orders for people. Just because again, back then, like 5-6 people, we all just kind of had to grind to kind of get business. But yeah, very, very early day stuff.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's how it is at most startups. I'd imagine people are doing a lot of different things. Maybe they don't have such a clearly defined role because they're helping out in other areas. I mean, yeah, you were, I believe, the only customer support person for quite some time, and that fell on your shoulders, among other things. And of course, the team and the company has expanded quite a lot since then, which is all very exciting. I actually wanted to ask a little bit about that. Like, when did it, at what point, like, how long were you working there, / how long were you learning to code, where you became like a full-time engineer? So not just, you know, the person who did all this different stuff, and some of it was coding, but you actually, like, that was like your main focus.
I want to say that happened probably like a year and a half into it. So like, and I always have to recount this, but I want to say I've been at like 8 different offices. And I want to say by like office number 3, I had transitioned purely into being a developer. At that point, I had hired on a couple of other people to work as customer support agents. And then one of them actually ended up taking over as our head of customer care, a woman named Tova Payne. Really, really awesome. If you're listening, Tova, I love you. And at that point, I transitioned fully to being a developer and have been more or less developing since. I now do engineering management, which is not quite development, but still in the engineering team.
Yeah, awesome. Tova's great. So actually, I want to take a quick break and come back because I want to talk to you more about your experience at a startup and advice you could share to others. So we'll be back in a second. Whether you're just starting to tinker with code or you already have several projects under your belt, Linode is a great place to host your websites and apps. In fact, with Linode, you can do way more than just that. You can set up your own VPN, run an online store, build a game server. There are so many possibilities. You can fully customize your Linode server yourself, or if you want to make things super easy, you can use one of their one-click apps to deploy a pre-built setup in seconds. They've got apps for WordPress, Minecraft, GitLab, and loads more. If you ever get stuck, Linode's customer service team is on hand 24/7, 365 days a year, over the phone and online. In fact, they've won a whole bunch of awards for their customer service, so you know you're going to be in good hands. I highly recommend using Linode for your next project. And you can actually get $100 in free credit when you create a new account with them. Just go to linode.com/learn to code and click the Create Free Account button to get started. All right, okay, so we're back. And I wanted to talk a bit more about just like working at a startup that small in general. So I know like the position sort of came to be like through Noah, who is the CTO of Teachable, who was also your roommate and college buddy. But like, what are your thoughts on someone just starting out, someone who's listening to the show right now, on working at a startup as a beginner in tech versus a larger, more established company?
Yeah, I think the thing with working at a startup is there's a lot to do. And I think it's both a good and a bad thing as somebody starting out. So like when I first started working at Teachable, like there was a ton of opportunity. So like just to name a few of the features I was able to basically architect within my first 2 years of working at Teachable, the captioning system for our video player, our quiz feature, and our webhooks infrastructure. And if you aren't familiar with webhooks, it's basically just something happens in my application and I want to send a payload of data somewhere else, right? Maybe you want to integrate with something. I was able to kind of work on all these things as a pretty junior developer because we didn't really have other people to do that sort of stuff, right? If you go to a bigger company, you're going to have a lot of mentoring, you're going to have a lot of structure, but like, there's a team of PhDs that have probably figured this stuff out. Whereas at a startup, there's a lot of opportunity for you just to try things and make mistakes, which are both good and bad because it lets you grow and lets you get a lot of new experiences. But like, as somebody who's been at the same company for 7 years, like if you last that long, those mistakes can kind of creep up on you and find you. So like, maybe you're 6 months in and you're like, I want to show that I'm learning and growing as a developer. Maybe you're feeling that imposter syndrome and you want to rebuild this thing just to show you can do it. Well, now you got to maintain that thing. And so 5 years later, you might still be having to maintain that thing just because you want to prove yourself when you're 6 months in. And so at a startup, you want to try and find opportunities to stretch and grow, but you also want to be mindful of the fact that like, you have to kind of own what you build. And so I think that's probably one of the biggest challenges at a startup, other than just the pace, right? Some people want to have a, here are my clearly defined set of responsibilities. And like I just described to you, like, yeah, I had some wild responsibilities when I started at Teachable, mostly because we just had to get that stuff done. And so you got to kind of be prepared to work past five a little bit or have to make calls or decisions or figure stuff out on the fly in a way that if you're at a more established company, you know, I'm assuming you don't. I haven't worked at Google, but I'm assuming it's that way.
Yeah, that makes so much sense. And when you were talking, I was also thinking about some things like what you said with the more loosely defined responsibilities and, you know, mentorship and like a clear cut role. Totally true. The other thing that I think is a really big difference, and I don't think people always realize this, is the like benefits and not just like healthcare. I also mean just like things like a 401k, you know, employee
employer 401k contributions and other benefits that bigger health companies will give out, like credits for, I don't know, like dog care or something, right? And oh goodness, oh, and even just salary in general. Like I know I have a lot of friends who work at bigger companies and they'll maybe have a higher, you know, base salary, and then they have all these different bonuses, and it can be kind of like complicated, but they can end up making, you know, quite a lot by the end of the year. But I feel like at a smaller company, there's just not like the HR, the resources to manage all of those different things. So usually like the pay could be less too, but I think it does come with different trade-offs.
Yeah. That's definitely the unfortunate situation. Like for instance, our taxes weren't great the first couple of years. Like I ended up having to owe the government because the withholdings were messed up. And, you know, like Ankur, our CEO, I love him to death, but like, oh yeah, there are definitely times like early on where it's like, payroll's a couple days late, just because again, like some of this stuff is just literally manual at this point. Like you don't have the HR, the infrastructure to get the stuff in place. And so, oh yeah, that was definitely something that I would recommend to your audience. Like if you're in a position not to rely on benefits, that's a very good position to be in at a startup, because I know for me, there were definitely times when I had to make trade-offs on like, do I work from home today or do I have dinner? Because I could either afford Subway or I could afford McDonald's, because yeah, I was just pretty strapped for cash. And like, had I had a family or anything like that, it just would have been a very untenable situation. And so any way you could build up savings and support to kind of account for that stuff, that would be great. Because yeah, most startups, unlike Google or Amazon or Facebook, just don't have the same benefits. And kind of the reality is a lot of startups don't become Facebooks and Googles and stuff. And so relying on that is a little bit tough, but I still think it's worth it, especially if you're starting off as a engineer, because again, there's so many opportunities and ways to grow. It's just one of those trade-offs you have to kind of make.
Yeah, right. Of course. So, and I feel like it's important for us to note that Teachable eventually got all those things, right? Like,
yes.
I remember when I started working there, there wasn't the 401k employer contribution thing, but I think like a year or so in, they began offering that. And I remember being like, oh my goodness, it felt like a milestone of being like a real company. There was health insurance and all that before that, but for some reason in my head, when that matching employer contribution, it was like a whole other level.
Oh yeah. And like, yeah. And you know, full disclosure for the audience, like Teachable did get acquired, and like, yes, I got some money out of that. But like, honestly, the 401k is easily how I'm making, you know, bank off of the company. Like that's one of the greatest benefits we've been able to get. And to your point, yeah, eventually we were able to kind of grow and get the sort of niceties that, you know, you think of when you think of startup world. So definitely something that does happen to most places. I guess I'm just thinking more of like, if you're trying to go for like the under 12 people sort of situation, yeah, it's probably not going to have cucumber water every day.
Yeah, right. No, exactly. And especially now that everyone is working from home, unless you make your own cucumber water, right? You're out of luck there.
Exactly.
Yeah. So transitioning a little bit, correct me if I'm wrong, but most of your time then at Teachable as a software engineer, and I think even today with management, you are working with internal tools, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay. So I don't think we've ever really talked about internal tools on the show before. So I'd love you to tell us about it. Like, what is internal tools and why does it matter?
Yeah. Internal tools basically are just, you know, different means or mechanisms by which employees can kind of do their jobs and do them better, right? So like the example I always like to explain to people of is Uber, right? Most people understand Uber. And if you don't understand Uber, I'm sorry, it's super convenient, but it's a ride sharing app where you can call for people to come take you from one place to the other. But if you're familiar with it, right, you have the version of the app that you see to call the driver. And then you have the version of the app that the driver sees to see, oh, somebody wants me to go pick them up. And then there's the third version that most people don't see, which only Uber support sees, which is, oh, I need to process a refund or I need to cancel this ride for somebody. That last version is effectively what I work on and my team works on. So we kind of work with the different teams inside of Teachable, and we try and help them use tools, whether they're like home-built proprietary tools or it's just kind of stitching together various vendors, we just try and help them do their jobs a little bit better, a little bit more efficiently.
Yeah, awesome. And how did you end up falling into that? And I have like, it's funny because I sort of have like my recollection of this story as like the outsider kind of looking in and looking at you and your role at Teachable, which I'm just going to give super quickly. I feel like you built the original staff app, right? And then that maybe was also coinciding with your help with support tickets, since you answered support tickets, you know, early on at the company. And I feel like then your role just evolved from that. And that was kind of like your domain was just the staff app and related things.
Yeah, that's definitely like, yes, that's more or less how it kind of came about. Slightly different spin and kind of going back to an earlier point, like, yeah, it was just kind of like an area where like, all right, our regular engineers aren't like, heck yeah, I want to build the admin platform for our platform. So it's just like, oh, I can kind of work on this. To your point, I was already pretty familiar with a lot of the use cases and why you would need a tool like this. And so I had pretty good background knowledge. And so, yeah, it was just an opportunity to basically like own an entire part of the system. So that kind of grew me there. And then since then, it's just kind of been like a sort of, that's been a domain area. I've kind of, I wouldn't say excelled in, but like it's kind of become my wheelhouse within the company at this point.
Okay. So you kind of explained the difference between like the admin interface and platform that like the customers are using mm-hmm. versus the staff app. And is it, side note, is that what you guys still call it? Cause I know that's what we called it when we were there.
Yes. Yeah. It's still called staff app because I am not very creative when it comes to naming things.
Okay. So the staff app. Okay. So then we have the staff app. What technologies and languages are being used to create and run and maintain that?
Yeah. So it's actually going through a bit of a migration right now. So where we're trying to move towards is Ruby on Rails backend, a GraphQL API with a React frontend. Historically, it was all just Ruby on Rails server-side programmed because for a long time, it was just me, and that was the language I first learned and was pretty comfortable with. We're trying to mix up some of the technology so to kind of better fit the rest of our front-end development at the company. And then we also have, I mean, it's kind of hard to describe, but like there's a series of just like smaller microservices that kind of power certain features. And those have been written in stuff like Node or Python, which are the three primary languages that I've used professionally at Teachable: Node, Python, and Ruby on Rails, or Ruby on Rails being the framework. But yeah, that's more or less the technology that we're using.
Right. So with like internal tools, do all companies or larger companies, maybe just software companies, I don't know, do they have that kind of team in some shape or form? And if they do, is it always called internal tools or are there other names for it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that a lot of companies do, but they may not always call it that. For instance, like we primarily focus on internal tools for our non-technical employees. So like customer care agents, some of our risk management team, financial users, stuff like that. There's also like developer tools, right? And a lot of companies will have people building developer tools, right? Things to allow you to deploy faster on like the infrastructure or DevOps side, or things to make front-end development a little bit easier. So like those teams very much do exist, but they may not be called an internal tools team. And that kind of highlights how even the name internal tools is a little broad and something we're always trying to think of, is there a better name for this? Because yeah, there's just different kinds of tools that people use internally. And so I think that a lot of times companies, especially tech companies, will just have a need for that sort of stuff. If you're a pretty simple standard, I'm running on Shopify e-commerce type of business, you probably don't. But like anytime you have like your own proprietary software, there's a possibility you might need to build bespoke technology to support it because there might not be a good off-the-shelf solution to just kind of like plug in and get everything you need.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I can't even imagine just like with Teachable and like the customer care tickets. And as you said, like other people who may need to use it, like people who are on the finance team or something. I don't even know how you would go about getting all that different information without having something like a staff app to log into, which is essentially just showing all of this different internal information for the different accounts that are on Teachable. So if someone has like a billing issue or they were supposed to get a payout and it never came, they can write into customer support. Customer support can kind of pull up their account details and like see where things stand. So it's really cool. And I would imagine a lot of companies similar Teachable to software, as you said, proprietary software would have something similar to this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's a huge array of options when it comes to that sort of stuff, right? Like there's a recent company called Retool, which is pretty popular in this space. And like, again, if you're just working with like, I got stuff in Shopify and I need to look at it in QuickBooks and kind of manage the two, there are tools like that which are really, really good for you. If you have something proprietary, but you don't want to build your own framework for it, there's stuff like in Ruby on Rails, like Rails Admin, which are pretty darn nifty, especially if you're a startup. And then if you have a pretty complex system with a lot of nuances and complexity, you might have to build some more like custom-made stuff. And so, yeah, I think that, you know, at the end of the day, like employees need a way to kind of manage stuff. And so some form or fashion, you'll probably have it. Again, it really just depends on what your other tech stack is and like what options you have available.
Yeah. So this may be a tough one. I'm not sure, but most of the folks listening right now are beginners, right? And for someone listening who thinks, oh, that actually sounds really interesting, like internal tools, I would love to work on a team like that at a tech company. What would you recommend would be a good way to go about that?
Well, so I think the first thing in terms of really any, I think this might be good advice for any sort of position at a company, is just showing interest, right? And especially if we're talking about like a smaller company where like you don't have a full team of people for a single button, people probably have a lot on their plates. Like I know for me and my team right now, right? Like we're still trying to hire. We got a bunch of good talented people, but we still have a huge backlog of stuff we're trying to get through. And so like if somebody's like, hey, I opened a PR and I added this feature or fixed this thing, I'm probably not going to say no. And like that kind of shows aptitude. And from there, that's where you start getting into internal transfer situation. Or if you want to, like, let's say, so I guess this is coming from like, let's say you're already at the company and you're like, oh, this team sounds cool and I want to start working with them. I think those kinds of opportunities could be really cool. If you're at a larger company, I'll be honest, I'm not super sure. But like, again, at smaller companies, I think most people probably don't care if you help out their lives and make their lives easier. If you're somebody who's like, I want to work in internal tools, but I am not working in a company and I want to figure out how to apply to that job, I think in general, especially if you're somebody brand new, just showing a lot of like grit might be the best way to put it. So like kind of going back to like, what project should I learn? Like have something up on Heroku, like have some app that shows like this person's willing to learn, they're curious, they're willing to put in the effort, and then reach out to the startup. Startups are constantly hiring. They're constantly looking for good people. That's the kind of stuff that really stands out. If I'm like looking at a resume, it's like, what kinds of projects are they doing? Like, are they just following that Rails Twitter clone tutorial, or are they, you know, pushing themselves? That was a long answer.
No, that was good. And I mean, cause you're hiring now, you've always been interviewing, but I think you have even more responsibility now on that front because you're a manager, right?
Yes.
So yep. When you're looking at someone's resume, since you do this a lot, or their website, their whatever they give to you on the application, are you looking at like their GitHub and seeing like what they've put out there?
Yes and no. I mean, GitHub's a little bit tricky. Like for instance, if you look at my GitHub, Ruby Bruce is a username. I don't really have that much up there because most of the work I'm doing is through my job and that's like private. So you can't really see my activity. And I wouldn't necessarily say that I'm like a poor candidate. And so if people have stuff on GitHub, that's awesome and that's great. If you don't, like, that's not necessarily a knock against you. I guess when I look at resumes, the stuff that I'm really looking out for is, like, what is the job history like, right? Like, are they jumping around from place to place? And, like, that's not necessarily a bad thing, but, like, you know, is it because the company went under? maybe you made Facebook for dogs and it just didn't work out. Like, that's totally fine. But, you know, I want to make sure that, like, you're the kind of person who's willing to stay at a place for a few years to try and, like, learn and all that sort of stuff, right? If you're, again, brand new, it's your first programming job, like, that's okay. But again, a little bit of consistency goes a long way. The other thing I like to do that isn't just on the resume, but more just like something I ask people in interview questions, which if you're able to handle this question, I think most of the time I'm usually like, yeah, we should bring them on, is talking about a time when you messed up and how you responded to it. All the good engineers I've worked with and known mess up. Like, they cost the company thousands of dollars. They took down a website during a big feature launch, like, just done really bad stuff, right? If you're not able to talk about that, then you're probably not being honest, or you're haven't been doing it long enough, or you haven't tried or whatever, right? And, you know, how you respond to those kinds of situations is important, because you probably will cause outages again. Spoiler alert, we all mess up. And how you respond to that's really, really important. More so than like, oh, you went to this boot camp or you went to this college. Like, that stuff really doesn't matter. So consistency, and then, you know, can you talk about like what you've done in the past, especially your mistakes?
Yeah, that's a really good tip. That makes a lot of sense why that would be a really good question to ask to gauge a person. And just even I'm thinking, at least with in-person interviews, you could just pick up a lot on their body language probably when they're talking about that. And that'd be really informative. Okay, so I'm switching gears kind of, but I really wanted to ask this. So I'm thinking about like your college experience, right? Studying film, philosophy, playing rugby / maybe football a bit in the beginning, and then mostly rugby. Mm-hmm. Is there anything that you learned in those areas that you think helped you in your career in tech?
Oh, yeah. So it's funny enough, philosophy actually has a lot more to do with computers than you think. So like, for instance, symbolic logic, which is a class I took, it's basically how computers work. We can get down to the nitty gritty. It's all like Boolean algebra and like logic gates and stuff like that. And so oddly enough, I find philosophy, remembering De Morgan's law, helps me out. But yeah, the other thing I think that honestly, of all my college experience, it really helped me a lot is being able just to cram and learn a lot of stuff in a short amount of time. One of the things I think is really important to kind of internalize is the fact that you're not going to learn everything. You're not even going to learn a fraction of everything. There's so much out there in terms of programming. And so being able just to like rapidly digest and get caught up with stuff is really, really important, more so than memorizing everything. And that kind of goes back to just getting as much exposure to things as possible and not getting hung up on the little things. Like, learn about Docker at a high level. You don't have to learn about every internal aspect of it, because if that's the approach you're taking, you're going to get bogged down. So learn the high-level overview, do what you need to do, move on. And that's kind of something I had to learn in college, writing dozens of 12-page papers on European philosophy.
That's really interesting. Yeah. And I'm glad that you had some things that carried with you and are, you know, helping you today. I don't think we ever spoke to anyone on the show that studied philosophy that I can think of, at least. But that adds up, I guess, like that there's similarities. I never studied it, so I don't know too much about philosophy, but I can see it helping for sure. The other thing I just wanted to ask, just to wrap things up, is any kind of like final advice or thoughts that you could leave people with who are trying to transition into software engineering, but they don't have, you know, they didn't go to a boot camp, maybe they didn't go to college, they don't have any work experience yet?
Yeah, that's... I would say the best advice I can give is try and put yourself out there as much as possible and try and connect with people as soon as possible. There's this like very weird prevalent stereotype that programming and engineering is this like antisocial thing. And like, that's very far from the truth. Like, even if you're just coding by yourself, you're using libraries that other people have used, and you're not going to know how they work perfectly. You're going to need to like learn how to talk with other people and ask the right questions and all that sort of stuff. And so if you're somebody who's like, I want to become an engineer and I don't know anybody, I don't know anything about programming, yes, the first thing is, you know, go to W3 schools and start learning about programming. Google how to build a website, do whatever you need to do just to start learning. But I would also encourage you to try and find other places. Look on Reddit, look on social media, try and see if there's anybody you went to high school with that might know about programming. Like, you would be surprised at how many people, even if it's not building an application for a big company, they're building websites. So try and connect to them, and, you know, just so you can ask them questions, right? Because purely learning online is possible, but it's a lot easier when you have somebody else. The other thing I would say is learn HTML and CSS. It is easy. It is simple. You don't need to know that much about how computers work, and it's an incredibly fast feedback loop. Programming is hard. You're going to get frustrated. It will take a lot of time, but just getting your name on a page, changing the font size, and then hitting refresh and seeing that change is the small bit of positive feedback loop that you want to be creating early on. And so if you're learning and you're like, I'm going to build an operating system, don't do that. It'll be too much. It'll be too long. Start off with HTML and CSS. And yeah, I don't know. Yeah, like I said, find a network, get people you can talk with, and learn something simple and easy at first. So you get used to, I make a change, I see it happen, because there's a lot of stuff you can learn and you just want to start off very simple.
Yeah, that's great advice. And I totally agree. I feel like also HTML and CSS can help you in like all these different ways. I'm just even thinking of like formatting a blog post on my own blog or something, and how there's times I need to make a small change or something with formatting, and just knowing like HTML and CSS helps with that. And likewise with a lot of different stuff you may want to do online, it can be helpful.
Oh yeah. It's a bit of a weird analogy. If you know me long enough, you'll know I love weird analogies, but like, it's a bit like the 21st century of equivalent of knowing how to change your car's oil or like fill up the, you know, tires with gas or something, or air. Don't fill up the tires with gas. That's a terrible idea. But yeah, I think, you know, everything's online. Everything is web-based. The other day I was trying to order something on Grubhub and I was able to debug an issue with the coupon code because the error wasn't showing, but I opened up the developer tools and I could see the error message at the JavaScript through. So yeah, I definitely think that even if you're, I don't want to become an engineer, I don't want to become a software developer, knowing HTML, CSS, and JavaScript is, yeah, you should just do it for modern life.
Awesome. Well, I think that's a great note to end things on. Thank you so much again, Mike, for coming on. And where can people find you online?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I don't really use Twitter that much, but I do have a Twitter account. I need to look it up. It is at Ruby Brews Day. You can find me on Twitter. I'm also on GitHub as Ruby Brews Day. That's just my general handle. I have a website, mikepogue.com, but there's not much on there. And yeah, if you want to, you know, shoot me a message on Twitter, I'll try and get back to you. And yeah, it's been great being on the show.
Awesome. Thank you so much again, Mike.
Yep.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you missed anything or would like a recap, you can find the show notes at learntocodewith.me/podcast. If you're listening to this episode in the future, simply click the search icon in the upper navigation of the website and search for the guest name. If you enjoyed this episode, you can subscribe to my show on whichever podcast player you use. For more free tech-related resources, tips, and recommendations, visit the website and blog over at learntocodewith.me. Thanks so much for tuning in, and I'll see you next time.